You're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. Good evening, I'm Al Voner, and this is this week's edition of The Public Eye. So nice to have you with us. Once again, I'm at it again. My love and my passion for history, especially U.S. history, has risen once again. And I came across a great book recently. But the thing I want to introduce to you, the listening audience, first and foremost, is the fact that, and I know you hear it as well, that there's an awful lot of dissent and a lot of hatred. I use that word because I really feel that's what's going on when we talk about political leadership in this country today. Some people thinking that we're seeing things we've never seen the likes of before. This disharmony, this controversy, the instability among political leaders is getting the country nowhere. It's not helping the American citizens. And you know, wherever you are on the political spectrum, it really doesn't matter. The fact of the matter is, and this is what I want to introduce to you this evening, is the fact that this is nothing new. This is something that has been ongoing since almost the founding of this country, if not from the very beginning. And to really support all of that, my guest this week is Paul Quigley, author of the new book, Man Behind the Cane. Mr. Quigley is also professor of Civil War history at Virginia Tech. And for the next half hour, we'll be talking with Paul Quigley about his new book and the fact that, as I said, even violence has been introduced oftentimes in U.S. history when it comes to our political leaders. Paul, nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Some people say, oh, geez, Al, I think you're going a little overboard here. I mean, it's not unusual for various political parties to have opposing positions or ideas. And that's all well and good. And that's absolutely true. But what I love about your book, Man Behind the Cane, and I'm going to give a little bit of insight to our listeners, is the fact that disharmony has been part and parcel of the political landscape in this country since day one. And in your book, you go back to the year 1856, just prior to the Civil War, where a South Carolina congressman by the name of Preston Brooks physically assaulted Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner with a cane, causing extensive physical harm. And this was on the floor of the Congress. And I'm going to let you fill it in from there, but, you get the sense that, my God, I mean, that really hasn't happened recently. So maybe what's going on now isn't quite as bad. But the point being that physical, political discourse is certainly part and parcel of the political environment in this country, is it not?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Al. If you look at American history, political violence has been a regular, if not completely constant, element of political culture. And at no time was this more apparent than in the 1850s, in the run-up to the Civil War, where there were various incidents of violence, including the caning you've just described. And the background to this was the big political fight over slavery. So Charles Sumner, the victim in the caning, was a congressman, a senator from Massachusetts, and he gave an abolitionist speech. And Preston Brooks, his assailant, was a representative from South Carolina who objected to the abolitionism in his speech. Sumner had also insulted several Southern politicians, including one of Preston Brooks's relatives. And so the assault was his effort to seek vengeance after that speech.
And what I learned from your book, Paul, and this was interesting because I didn't really have a firm handle on it, is that in that particular period, especially for a man entering politics, a number of things came into play. One, image, egos, reputation. One had to defend. It was almost part and parcel of being a man in that period of time, defending one's positions, defending one's image, because it all came back to basically a cloud hanging over not only the individual but the family, and nobody wanted that. So certainly, ego played a big part in all of this. But in addition to Preston Brooks attacking Charles Sumner, Was this an isolated incident in that particular period? Now, we're leading up to the Civil War. So, you know, as you talked about, abolitionism was a very controversial topic at the time. But were there other, you know, was this kind of commonplace that if you don't agree with me or if I don't agree with you, we're going to duke it out?
Yeah, unfortunately, so it was rather common. And there's a great book by the historian Joanne Freeman called The Field of Blood. And she goes through and explores literally dozens of different violent conflicts in and around Congress in the years leading up to the Civil War. So, you know, the caning was the most spectacular, it's the most visible because of where it took place, because of the severity of the assault, but it wasn't the only one.
Paul, how did fellow congressmen, senators, you know, those who were present, did they just stand by and let it happen, or you know, were people rushing to help you know, Charles Sumner, or did they try to, you know, dislodge what was going on? I mean, how did that you know, what happened on that particular day?
There were actually a range of responses. There were 20 odd people still in the Senate chamber. You know, the Senate had adjourned, but people were still there, some of them senators, others visitors. And there was a whole range of reactions. You know, the first thing to bear in mind is this was a quick, sudden, unexpected attack. It lasted about a minute. So for some people, there just wasn't time to react. There was at least one of Brooks's friends in the room, Lawrence Kitt, who famously held back bystanders by holding his own cane in the air and threatening them if they got involved. So that was a disincentive for anyone to try and get in there. There were people, for example, John Crittenden, who was a senator from Kentucky. He tried to shout, you know, don't kill him, words to that effect, and he was held back as well. And then at the end of the minute-long assault, there were a couple of congressmen from New York State who made their way over to the fight, the attack, and were either about to intervene or maybe stopped it just as it was ending. But really, like I say, it only lasted a minute. There wasn't much time for anyone to do much of anything.
But nonetheless, Charles Sumner certainly, you know, certainly received quite a beating in that short period of time. I guess if I were to walk into the Congress at that period and not want to be sitting next to or getting into a disagreement with someone that was carrying a cane. But with that in mind, though, Paul, something else that you mentioned in the book is that dueling threats of, you know, if you challenged another, not just in the political environment, but because we're talking about this being a political topic, the fact that in that period of time, men often challenged one another to a duel if they felt that, one, you weren't in agreement with their way of thinking, or that perhaps there was an insult, a subtle insult, or something that just hit them the wrong way. How common was that?
Yeah, it was still fairly common. It was illegal by this point, but it still happened quite a lot, particularly in the South, particularly among, you know, the elite slaveholders like Preston Brooks. And in fact, Preston Brooks had been involved in a duel as a young man, which had resulted in a fairly serious leg wound. And as you say, there's just this expectation in that culture that if you're insulted, if your family is insulted, which of course happened with the Sumner speech, you would fight back physically in a duel if it was a social equal who had administered the insult, or with some other kind of punishment if you did not view the person who had insulted you as a social equal. And so that's why, you know, people sometimes ask, why didn't Brooks challenge Sumner to a duel? And a big part of it was that he did not consider Sumner to be a social equal.
Hmm. The other thing I want to bring into, just so listeners have a better understanding, is the fact that Preston Brooks came from a well-regarded Southern family. They had well-to-do. He had an older brother who died in the in wartime as a hero in that period of time, going to war, and you know, obviously, family was hoping he'd come back. But if indeed you were wounded or even killed on the battlefield, you were considered a hero. Preston Brooks went to the Mexican-American War, military service in the Mexican-American War. And I always get the sense, Paul, I want to get your feeling on this, that he felt that he had something to prove. You know, his father, like I said, was well-known, his older brother, the family had a reputation. Was this a gentleman that felt that he, you know, one of his main objectives was to prove himself and his worth, his self-worth?
Absolutely, yeah. And this, you know, it was a common thread of manhood back then, and still to some extent today. You know, people then thought being a man was about dominating others and proving oneself by acting that role in the public eye. And Preston Brooks certainly felt as though he had to do that. And the war, you mentioned the Mexican War in the late 1840s, was his big opportunity to do that. And as you know from reading the book, unfortunately for Preston Brooks, he was not able to really do much of fighting in Mexico because he came down with typhoid fever and got sent home to recuperate.
Yeah,
he lost his chance.
I'm certainly not suggesting that you know that he all of this gave reason or gave him the right, I should say, to attack Charles Sumner. But I think you know, and I'm hoping listeners you know hear this, is the fact that one's image and reputation within a community was. As Paul said, very, very important. I'm going to just take a quick pause to remind our listeners that you're tuned to 90.5 WICN, Jazz Plus for New England. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Listen online at WICN.org. I'm Al Vona, host of The Public Eye. My guest this week is author and educator Paul Quigley. His book is Man Behind the Cane. And in 1856, especially if he's just joining us, a South Carolina congressman by the name of Preston Brooks physically assaulted Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner on the floor of the Congress with a cane, causing quite a bit of physical harm. Paul, going back to that period of time, another element is that the slaveholders in the South, those who made fortunes by invoking slavery to gain that wealth, versus others in other parts of the country, especially the North, the Northeast. As you said at the outset, abolitionism was quite the topic. Did this incident by any chance move the country closer to civil war?
I think it did. I think historians, some of them in the past, have maybe overplayed that angle a little bit by describing this, you know, as the first blow of the Civil War and that kind of thing. I don't think it was that simple, because it was just one incident among many, but it certainly did accelerate the ongoing trend toward polarization between the North and the South around slavery. And I think, you know, physical violence does that. If there's a political conflict already underway and somebody gets hurt physically, it's more than likely going to accelerate that existing conflict. And that's exactly what happened. So you see Northerners who maybe hadn't been, you know, wouldn't have considered themselves abolitionists by any stretch. But when one of their guys got attacked by one of the Southern congressmen, they reacted maybe by moving towards acceptance of violence or just getting involved with the conflict more than they already had done. Similar kind of thing on the Southern side. After this conflict, they were more likely to think, okay, if slavery continues to be this much of an issue, we are going to have to fight about it and continue to fight about it.
As long as I can remember, and it's still in existence to this very day, there's a Speaker of the House, there's a leadership who opened the meetings, closed the meetings, and basically, move things along. And I imagine part of their responsibilities is also to keep things as civil as possible. But going back to this period, the mid-1800s, prior to the Civil War, was there a leadership in place? Was there a House Speaker? Was there a Senate President? Were there people who would normally gavel and step in and say, okay, you gentlemen, stop right there. We've had enough of this. Let's calm down. Let's take a recess and talk it over in committees. Or were these individuals just thrown into a room and, whatever happened?
Yeah, they had a similar kind of leadership structure in the Congress then as they do now. So there was a Speaker of the House, for example. Of course, when the attack happened, that didn't come into play because the Senate had been adjourned. But after the attack, that was one of the places you might look for some kind of conflict resolution process. But what happened was the Senate chose not to investigate the caning. They didn't want to get involved with this. They wanted to ignore it. In the House, they had an investigation into the caning, initiated by the Speaker of the House and the leadership. And that process played out and ended up with Brooks being almost expelled from the House. The vote was held. More than half of the representatives voted to expel Brooks because of the caning, but not the required two-thirds that it would have taken to actually expel him. So there was a process of justice led by the House leadership, did not result in expulsion, although actually what Brooks did after that vote was he stood up and decided to resign anyway, even though the expulsion vote had not passed. He resigned to make a point.
I'm glad you mentioned that because, I'm in no way defending the actions of Preston Brooks, but what I have understood, getting a better handle on after reading A Man Behind the Cane, is that I don't think that he was necessarily an angry, diabolical kind of individual. I think he felt a lot of pressure, as we talked about earlier. He hoped to have made a name for himself in the Mexican War. I mean, he chose to do this. He wanted to keep the honor of the family. But I think more importantly, it goes back to that period of time, that Preston Brooks was somebody who felt that he had something to prove. And each time that he got up to the to a point where he had the opportunity to perform, something or someone or an event curtailed that. And because even some of the writings, he talks about his wife, he talks about his children losing a child. So I get a sense that the guy wasn't all bad, is what I'm trying to say. Is that true?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. And that's one of the goals of the book, is try to understand Preston Brooks as a person. Like you said, not to kind of rehabilitate his reputation or say the caning was justified or anything like that, but just because I think it behooves us to try to understand why people do what they do, even when they do these terrible things, that doesn't define their whole life.
Did Preston Brooks have any regrets shortly thereafter?
I think he did. There are some examples in the book, and it's not the strongest evidence. Like, we don't have a smoking gun like Preston Brooks coming out and saying, I regret what I did or anything like that. But there are some indications that he wasn't completely satisfied or proud of what he had done. And that fits, I think, with the rest of his personality that you learn about in the book. He's one of these guys who's never quite happy with himself, always feels like he's falling short. And I think with the caning, he became a hero in the South, but he became almost the devil in Northern eyes. And that was a really hard position for a guy like him.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm thinking that was my next question. The public's opinion on that. I know that, the idea of slavery was certainly something that was putting a wedge between, various parts of the country. So that certainly elevated the tension that was going on here in the country. But more importantly, it wasn't like, the everyday man and woman across the South were like, oh, Preston Brooks, you embarrassed us. You should not be representing us. Many people saw him as a hero. And as you said, vice versa, when you went further north and people who believed in abolition, people who didn't believe in slavery, thinking of him as nothing more than a scoundrel who should not hold a position of leadership like that. So public opinion was pretty much something that really put a wedge between various parts of the country, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think this is one of the things I learned about political violence along the way, is it does tend to make people more radical than they already are. So even people in the North, for example, who were not abolitionists, because abolitionists were such a tiny minority, even in the North at this point. But after the caning on Sumner, they were more likely to sympathize with him to some degree. And then in the South, what you see is there are quite a lot of murmurings of discontent about what Brooks did, particularly where he did it, because doing an attack like this in the sacred space of the United States Senate did not seem like a good move, even to people who generally supported Brooks's position. But even they tend to fall in line behind him after the caning, because they want to support their guy. They want to be part of the Southern slaveholder group. And so that's what acts like this do. They kind of drive people apart and force them to take positions that they might not otherwise have taken.
Two things. One, how badly hurt was Charles Sumner, for one? And then secondly, after the event, did he in any way, or did Brooks in any way, did Brooks try to apologize? Was Sumner forgiving? So two things that I want to get a sense from you on regarding both these gentlemen.
Yeah, Sumner was very seriously wounded. He was briefly unconscious. He had multiple lacerations on his head, that, you know, that's where the attack was focused. And two of those lacerations in his head actually went down to the bone. One of them required immediate, I think they both required immediate stitches. One of them later became infected. So, you know, this is a serious attack we're talking about here. And in terms of how the two guys acted after the attack, Brooks never attempted to apologize to Sumner. You know, he, at least in public, owned what he did. He pled guilty in the court. He paid his fine. He gave speeches. You know, in some way, he welcomed his new reputation as the man behind his cane, behind the cane, even though, as I mentioned before, I think there were some quiet misgivings even in his own mind. As for Sumner, he did not comment that much publicly on the caning. Toward the end of his life, which was in the mid-1870s, he did issue a statement to the effect of, let's let bygones be bygones. You know, I can set that aside. It happened a long time ago. I'm not sure if he wanted to forgive Preston Brooks, but he was moving in that direction.
Yeah, so at least he was, you know, willing to, you know, put things aside and, you know, for the good of the country, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I get the sense, and you touched upon it, but I want to get your, because you researched this gentleman's life, Preston Brooks, he missed out on proving himself many, many times. But this particular time, he was, as they say, he was in the public eye.
Yeah.
All light, you know, everything was focused on him. He never publicly said, I did wrong. I was out of control. I shouldn't have done that. It's not like me. Whether he felt that way or not, you know, I don't particularly know. But let me ask you: was this perhaps that shining moment that Preston Brooks had been hoping for? The one time in his life when he was recognized for something, even though members of the government felt that it was wrong in what he did, because you did say that you know, public sentiment in the South saw him as a hero. So was this something that perhaps had avoided him for so long? Was this his moment in the sun?
Yeah, I do think this was his opportunity to prove himself in a way that he hadn't been able to do properly before. I think he had that record of wanting to prove his manhood in the public arena, and this was his way of doing it. And the bigger thing, honestly, is that he was afraid of the consequences if he did not act against Sumner. He did not want to be accused of being a coward. And that had happened in his life before, like with the Mexican War years we talked about earlier. Even though people weren't coming right out and saying, you were a coward, you came home, that was what he was always afraid of. And same thing in 1856, he knew that Sumner had offended Brooks's family. his father's cousin, Andrew P. Butler, was one of the targets in Sumner's speech. And so Brooks knew that people would expect him, as the closest family member on the scene, to do something about it. And so he felt an obligation to do it and seize that moment. And that's what he did.
As we start to wind down, I can't help but, again, what I got from the book, and I mentioned this at the outset, is the fact that for me personally, what I took from that is that, especially in that period of time, image, ego, reputation, defending all of that was so important, especially to a male. And one in this particular case whose family had a solid reputation in the South, and now he was a member of Congress. And as you said, he felt he had something to prove. But was this common, I guess is what I'm trying to say, in that period, you know, the mid-1800s and even going forward from there, that ego certainly played a big part in behavior of many people?
Yeah, absolutely. It did back then. You know, and there were different ideas about what really made a man a man. If you look at different regions of the country and different points in time, but that is a constant. I think that reputation, what other people in the community think of me, is really, really important. And that's what men often are willing to fight to defend.
Yeah. Before we close out, I just want to say that, you know, I did mention it at the beginning that we're seeing a lot of political disharmony and discord right here in the year 2026. It is nothing new. Obviously, no, there are, at least to my knowledge, Paul, I don't know about you, I don't hear of any more canings or, you know, people, members of Congress threatening one another to duels. And if they're doing it, they're doing it on their own time behind closed doors. But you know, when people talk today and they think, oh God, you know, what's happened to our country? What's happened to government? Why aren't our political leaders, you know, working on behalf of the people for the good of the country? There's always been discourse. There's always been disharmony. And it does go back many, many years. I'm not defending it. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. All I'm saying is that Paul's book, Man Behind the Cane, is certainly one particular episode in U.S. history where political discord certainly was quite relevant. Paul, before we close out real quick, obviously the book is widely available, Man Behind the Cane, the story of South Carolina Congressman Preston Brooks causing physical harm by caning Senator Charles Sumner of Massachusetts on the floor of the Senate and causing quite a bit of physical harm. Paul, if people want to get more information, perhaps reach out to you directly, how might they do that?
Yeah, they could Google Paul Quigley, Virginia Tech. You'll find me fairly easily, and I welcome any feedback or questions about the book.
Sounds good to me. Again, the book is Man Behind the Cane. My guest has been Paul Quigley. From the Public Eye, and to you and to yours, we want to thank you so much for tuning in. For the Public Eye, this is Al Vona.